Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. 2-for-1, no concern for the future. Living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow, mad cow, mad cow line dance song.
Hey, Sun Guy Nation, welcome to the show here on another Friday afternoon. QT and Sun Guy with you like usual. First Friday of 2019, and if you're looking for wrestling tonight, WCWO at the Outlaw Arena in Indianapolis, PSW in Piedmont, Alabama, RCW in Calgary, Alberta, APW in Royston, Georgia, NSCW in Franklin, Kentucky, SCW in St. Paul, Minnesota, and SWF in Tullahoma, Tennessee. Tomorrow night, HPW back in Columbus, Indiana, as is Emerge Wrestling, NGW, where you can find me in Tacoma, Washington, Woo America in Bremerton, Washington, BPW in Deerfield Beach, Florida, PWA in Springfield, Illinois, CEW in Ottumwa, Iowa, PPW in Flint, Michigan, RWC in Radford, North Carolina, RSWF in Memphis, Tennessee, and WAR in Lima, Ohio tomorrow. QT, sounds like a full docket of shows to start the year off right.
Yes, and Sangha, you mentioned Ottumwa, Iowa in your wrestling show notes. Ottumwa, Iowa was where Radar O'Reilly was fictionally from. Radar O'Reilly.
He definitely was. You're right.
Yes. Now, how do you think Radar O'Reilly, if he could, if his character could travel, time travel in time, could he have done in the Pacific Northwest wrestling scene?
Not too well. He was pretty small.
He was pretty small, yes, and he was unfailingly polite, also.
Generally speaking, I would say, yeah.
Yes. I think the only wrestler he could probably manage to last a couple minutes with would have been Psycho Sailor or Sunny Days, in my opinion.
What about Haru Sasaki?
Oh, no. I think that would have been Haru Sasaki's first win. Yes. Even though Haru Sasaki was a wily ring veteran.
Okay. Well, when Radar would have been in his prime, he wouldn't have been a veteran, right?
Probably not. Yes. Now, Sun Guy, of all my rankings, my Pacific Northwest 9 7/8 of 2017, were there any that stood out in your mind?
In 2017, most of them. But I believe our guest is here, QT. Let's bring him on right away. I believe we have with us our guest today, Steve Shives. Are you with us?
Yes, I am. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you for joining us here today. Now, you a little bit
Absolutely.
Different than a lot of our guests. You're not really, per se, working in the wrestling industry, but you have done a lot of YouTube and blog type of work on reviewing wrestling. You are a lifelong fan from what I understand. What first
mm-hmm.
led you to get into watching professional wrestling?
Well, first of all, thank you for breaking the format of your show to have me on. It's nice to be a guest, even though I've not actually worked in the industry. You're right. I've been a fan since I was a little kid. I think the first little bit of pro wrestling, the earliest bit that I can remember is I'm 38 years old, so I grew up in the 80s, and I remember the angle that I think was – part of the build to the Hogan-Andre rematch in 88, where they did an angle. Either it was on a Saturday night's main event, or like an episode of Superstars or one of their weekly shows, or maybe Primetime, where they did the contract signing and Andre turned on Hogan and choked him out. So this was, and I remember going to school the next day after watching it, and a bunch of my friends were talking about it, and I had just become, that was like my first real exposure to pro wrestling, and I didn't know who was who. I didn't know who was supposed to be the good guy and who was supposed to be the bad guy. So I figured, well, Andre is the big guy who was choking out Hogan, so he was my guy. He was the guy I liked. And, you know, all my friends who've been watching all along were big Hulkamaniacs, and they were upset because Andre had choked out Hulk. And I was like, yeah, that's right, he did. You know, Andre's the man. And I eventually flip-flopped on that once I became a more regular viewer. But that's, I'm pretty sure it was early 1988, so I was 7 years old. And that was when I first saw it, and I was just hooked right away.
Now, I happen to be at that Hogan-Andre match of which you spoke. That's when there was the twin referee situation, and Hogan clearly kicked out at two, but the count kept going. It was Andre's only world title run. As brief as it was, he immediately surrendered the title, or as he called it, the world tag team title. Did you get to watch that particular match? Because at the time, it was the highest rated wrestling match ever viewed on television. I believe it may still hold the record for broadcast television.
I think you're right. I think it did. It still is. It's the largest number of viewers to watch a wrestling match. And yeah, I do remember watching it when it was on. And yeah, it was, I mean, you know, again, I had just become a fan. To me, it was all, I was as much of a mark as you could possibly be. And I mean, in a lot of ways, even today, I still am. I remember just, you know, thinking that it was all a legitimate contest, that it was like a sport, and thinking when they do the twin referee gimmick, it was just, it blew my mind. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And nowadays, you know, now I look back on that match now and I think, wow, that's what it took to get Hogan to lose the title. He said, sure, I'll lose it, but I'm going to lose it to Andre, and we're going to have a fake referee, and I'm going to totally kick out at two, and they're going to count three anyway, and then he's going to give the title away, right? I mean, it just, when you think about how ridiculous that is, just to get the title off of a guy, to move it to a new guy, it's kind of silly when you think about it today. But yeah, I remember watching that. I remember when I was growing up, and in my first sort of phase of wrestling fandom, Saturday night's main event was like appointment TV. I didn't miss very many of those at all.
Now, you have been a YouTube sensation for a while now. You started doing wrestling commentaries quite a while ago. You've kind of drifted into other forms of commentary, Star Trek most notably. You do several different ones. But when you were doing the wrestling YouTube videos, was that something that made you enjoy wrestling that much more, or did it detract from your enjoyment when you were reviewing it to that degree? Did it really affect your fandom?
Well, you know, I used to host, we did a regular live wrestling show on my YouTube channel. It was me and a buddy of mine, Doc Gregory, who has worked in the independent scene here in our area, in the sort of Maryland, West Virginia region. He, at that point, he had been involved for close to 20 years as a wrestler and then as a referee. And so he was sort of he was the smart one. He was the one who had the inside information. And I was sort of coming at it from the fan's perspective, and Doc could come at it more from a professional, you know, someone who had actually worked in the industry for a long time. And it was a lot of fun. And yeah, I think it did affect my fandom. It encouraged me to find good things to talk about with the WWE product at the time, because that was mostly what we talked about. We would do like a review of Raw every week, and we would go over it, you know, segment by segment, and what did we like and what didn't we like. And it reminded me that, you know, I'm supposed to enjoy this stuff, and I'm someone who by nature is very critical, and I can look at wrestling And it's easy to find the stuff I don't like about it from my fan's perspective. You know, again, as someone who's never worked in the industry, who's never been trained as a wrestler, I look at it as just any other form of theater or entertainment. And it's easy for me to be critical and to be negative, but doing the show and not wanting the show to be really negative or really angry or, you know, me just talking down about stuff all the time, it encouraged me to find things about it that I liked. And at the time, that was hard because I was not really enjoying the WWE product. And actually, I haven't enjoyed the WWE product very much for the last quite a few years. It's been a long time since I really, really enjoyed the mainline, mainstream WWE product. And so that, yeah, the show did affect my fandom because it gave me a reason to look for positive things, to not just complain about everything, but to say, okay, but yeah, I didn't like this and I didn't like this, but oh, that was good. You know, that reminded me why I'm a fan of this stuff. So, yeah.
I mentioned your Star Trek videos. You are the host of Trek Actually and Not Actually,
yeah.
Trek Actually, where you do commentary on various topics of Star Trek. You review the movies and some of the episodes mm-hmm. of the various Star Trek series. When you look at the fan bases of professional wrestling and Star Trek, what do you see as the similarities and the differences between the two fan bases of these genres?
That's a great question, because there are a lot of similarities. People who are only fans of one and not the other might not think so, because wrestling and Star Trek on the surface are very different from each other. But I've found that there's a lot of similarities. The first, the main thing is, in the very general way, there are fans of both things who love everything no matter what, who are just not critical of anything. If it's Star Trek, they'll love it and have nothing bad to say about it. If it's wrestling, they'll love it and have nothing bad to say about it. And there are also the people on the opposite side who seem to not like very much of it at all, and you wonder why they're even fans of it. Why do you even watch it if you hate it so much? So both fan bases have those sort of polar opposite groups who either love everything or hate everything. And then there are people, again, the kind of wrestling fan that I try not to be, although sometimes I get ahead of myself and I can't help it, where you look at everything in terms of what you would do differently. You know, there are always wrestling fans who watch a show, and if they don't like it or they don't like the way it turned out, you automatically start to sort of rebook it in your mind. And you say, well, what they should have done is do this and this and this, and I don't know why they did that, and why did that match get so much time, and this, and they had to rush through that one. And, you know, you've never worked in the industry. You've never worked on a TV show. You don't know what the pressures on the wrestlers or the agents or the producers or anything. You just see it as this product, and you think, well, why didn't they do this differently and that and that and that and that? And the same thing happens when you are a critic of a movie or a TV show. You look at it as a member of the audience, and you just imagine that if you were in charge, it would be this perfect world, and you could just fix it. You could just do everything that you want to do differently, you could just do differently. And it's usually not that clean cut. So that's something that both fan bases definitely have in common as well. And, of course, and you know, and there are people who are the purists who think, well, no, you think you're a wrestling fan, but I'm really a wrestling fan because I'm a fan of this. This is the best wrestling. Or, you know, I'm a real Star Trek fan because I'm a fan of that Star Trek show. That was the best one, and everybody knows it, and your favorite Star Trek sucks. And, you know, so there's a lot of similarities in the way that the fans interact with their favorite things, definitely.
One of the things that you touched on in your 2018 commentaries on professional wrestling on your YouTube channel was the ongoing controversy and ongoing, I don't want to call it problem, but issue
yeah.
that WWE has working with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Looking at what has transpired since the WWE signed their contract to run shows there, and having gone through a couple of those shows now, where do you see WWE's business domestically going, if anywhere, based on what's been happening with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia?
I mean, honestly, I really don't think that the Saudi Arabia thing is going to wind up hurting them all that much, which I think is a shame, because I think it should hurt them. I was not a fan. I had a big problem with them doing those shows, specifically the second one, because it happened after the murder of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed almost certainly with the involvement of the Saudi crown prince. So it's like the Saudi government had this guy who was very critical of their government murdered. And a lot of other, not a lot, but a few major American businesses who had interest in Saudi Arabia kind of took a step back and said, well, maybe we shouldn't be as cozy with these guys as we are. And the WWE just plowed right ahead and said, nope, we're still doing it. They gave us a lot of money. We're going to have the show. I think they deserve to be hurt for that. I think they deserve to lose business for that, because I think that was a bad move. But I really don't think it's going to end up hurting them at all. I mean, they have this, they're getting ready to enter this new domestic TV deal where SmackDown is going to move to Fox. And I think the amount that Fox is paying WWE just for the right to air SmackDown for a few years is close to $1 billion altogether. So they've entered this era of their business where most of their income seems to come from TV deals and rights packages and stuff like that. And, you know, if they do something that hurts their ticket sales or hurts the number of subscribers to the WWE network, it really doesn't hurt their bottom line all that much. So I don't think it's going to affect them too much at all. Now, I think maybe if there's enough discontent, like in the fan base, if there's enough fans like me who say, you know what, I love wrestling, but I just can't support this company anymore, I'm going to find another place to watch wrestling, then I think it could open up enough of a crack that someone else could come in and create maybe a little bit more of a competitor for them. But I don't think they're really going to lose all that much because of the Saudi thing. And as I say, I think that's a shame, because I thought the whole Saudi situation was terrible.
I noticed when they were promoting the event last fall, they suddenly stopped putting a lot of emphasis on where the show is going to be held. Going forward, do you think that this is something they will continue to do, where they announce these big events? I don't know if they're specifically pay-per-views or not, but the big events without mentioning where they're held, or do you think they'll once again go to promoting that they're being held in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia?
That'll be interesting to see. I don't know. As someone who no longer watches their product, I don't have a huge vested interest in it, because I watch other wrestling companies now. I haven't watched WWE for over 2 years now, but I keep up with it. You know, I follow things through websites and recaps and stuff, just because it's the biggest company, and I want to at least keep track of what's going on generally. And it'll be interesting to see what the next Saudi show is like, because they have this deal with them where they're supposed to do, I think, two shows a year for the next 10 years or something ridiculous like that. And it'll be interesting to see if they try to ride that out and do that whole deal just because there's so much money involved, or if they'll find some graceful way to sort of back out of it, or if they'll keep doing weird stuff. That's a really good observation, that they did the Crown Jewel show, but apparently during the broadcast they never mentioned that it was in Saudi Arabia. And for the couple weeks leading up to it, after it became controversial, they stopped saying that it would be in Saudi Arabia. They just referred to it generically as Crown Jewel, and they didn't mention where it was from, which was a really weird sort of thing to do. If I had to guess, I would say they would probably do that. They would probably, at least in the United States, they would try to promote the shows without mentioning or without playing up the Saudi connection, and they'll just play up the Saudi connection overseas, maybe where it's not as controversial. If I had to guess, they'd probably do that. But it'll be interesting to see if they fulfill, you know, the entirety of this agreement, or if they find some way to sort of you know, shake hands and say, but we're gonna bow out before the end of this, you know.
You mentioned other wrestling shows that you watch. One of the biggest one of the year, every year, is Wrestle Kingdom. It just wrapped up earlier this morning from Japan. Are you a fan of what New Japan Pro Wrestling has been doing, or they've grown Wrestle Kingdom to the point that now American fans are staying up until the wee morning hours to watch their biggest show of the year?
Yeah, actually, yeah. As I said, I haven't watched WWE for 2 years now. So Wrestle Kingdom the last 2 years has been like my WrestleMania. I'm a huge fan of what New Japan is doing. Actually, I just watched Wrestle Kingdom before I called in to your show here. I haven't watched all of it. I didn't watch it live. I didn't stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning to watch it live. But I watched the replay of it, and I haven't watched all of it because it's 5 hours long, and I just didn't have time to watch all of it. But I watched up until the last match. So I haven't seen Omega versus Tanahashi, but everything else I've seen. And I thought it was a really good show. I'm a big fan of New Japan. I couldn't be more excited that they're running more shows in the United States. And also they just announced they're running a big show in London this year as well. So they're really, you know, spanning the globe and starting to do more live events outside of Japan and hold more big cards and pay-per-views that are based outside of Japan. And I think that's awesome. You know, they're co-promoting Madison Square Garden this year with Ring of Honor, which is a huge deal because no wrestling company other than WWE has run Madison Square Garden for, I mean, it's something like 30 or 40 years, if not even longer. That's like MSG is WWE territory. So for New Japan and Ring of Honor to get in there is really, really cool. And I think they're doing a big show in Chicago, and they're doing a big show in Texas coming up and in North Carolina. So I'm a big fan of what New Japan is doing. And I like that style. I like the New Japan product, to use the trendy term for it. I just think they have a lot of really, really talented guys. I think Kazuchika Okada is awesome. I think Tetsuya Naito is awesome. Just a really, really strong roster. So yeah, New Japan is definitely something that has like filled that gap for me after I stopped paying attention to WWE.
We found out officially this week that members of the Elite from the Bullet Club are forming their own promotion. They have a billionaire backing them, and they apparently have a television deal in place with WGN. We know that the Young Bucks and the American Nightmare Cody will be there, along with several other members of the Elite, and I'm sure other top independent stars and possibly some New Japan stars. What do you think of the announcement of this promotion coming off the heels of when they presented All In and had a really hugely successful show out of nothing, basically?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's great. I think it's cool. Cody is my favorite wrestler at the moment, and I've admired everything he's done since he left WWE. I think he's really, and the Young Bucks as well. They've really sort of laid out this way that an independent wrestler can make a living and get themselves over and become a star without having to sign with WWE, which, you know, not everybody can do what they've done. Not every independent wrestler is going to become a massive star like they have, but they've at least proven that it's possible, you know. And I think that's really cool and really important. And yeah, they announced the formation of, they're calling it All Elite Wrestling. And they're going to have, I guess, on January 8th, they're going to have a press conference to give more details about it. But yeah, I think it's really exciting and really cool. I don't think that they're going to be able to provide like major competition to WWE right away, because WWE is just so far ahead and is such a huge company. But I think they'll be able to provide an alternative. And for fans like me who are looking for styles of pro wrestling that aren't represented in WWE and looking for a company that is a little easier to support just ethically than WWE is, and looking and to give other wrestlers a place that they can go. You know, so if you want to make some money as a wrestler and earn a living, you don't have to hope for the WWE contract. You can go somewhere else, and you don't have to hope that Impact is still going to be around, because Impact was that, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. That was, oh, well, you could always go to Impact or TNA. And now that sort of, you know, it's just kind of hanging on, but it's not really a viable option anymore, at least not comparable to WWE. But yeah, I think it's really cool. I bought All In on pay-per-view. I watched it live. I thought for the most part it was a really, really good show. I was excited by it. I thought it was really encouraging to see an independent show draw 10,000 people to a live event plus pay-per-view and everything else. I thought it was great. So yeah, I wish them all the best. And I, whenever their TV deal is announced and I find out where I can watch it, I'm definitely going to be watching their TV, because I want to see what they do. You know, I'm really, really excited about it.
One of the things in professional wrestling that has picked up a lot of steam in the last few years, not only just in WWE, but outside of WWE, yeah, it's become big, and that is lady professional wrestling. We see a lot more emphasis on lady matches these days. Ring of Honor has a championship for the women to compete for now. As of this past spring, you see a lot of headlining matches that involve women now. You have the revamped WOW coming back to television on Access TV, GLOW, the fictional series on Netflix was a huge success, as was the GLOW documentary chronicling the original GLOW. What do you think of this emergence of women's wrestling as something that is not just a niche product anymore, but it seems to have garnered a lot of mainstream support?
I think it's great. I think it's about time. I thought that it was cool. Again, we're going back maybe 10 years when there was that, maybe not quite 10, but several years ago, there was that brief window in TNA wrestling where their women's division, the Knockouts division, was really hot. And they were having great matches, and Awesome Kong and Gail Kim were sort of the top stars, and they were having these great matches and main eventing TV. And I thought that was great. And then it kind of died off when Hogan and Bischoff came into TNA and they said, okay, enough of that. And yeah, I thought, and then in NXT, when the women wrestling in NXT started to become like something that you had to see, that was a major highlight of the show. And then they made it a point to do that on the mainline WWE program as well, when they called up, you know, Charlotte and Sasha and Bayley. And I think it's awesome. I think it's great. One of my favorite independent wrestlers, I guess technically she's not independent, I think she's signed with Impact, but I love Tessa Blanchard. I think she's amazing. I think she has a great look. I think she's awesome in the ring, and she's one of my favorite wrestlers. And she was in that the women's four-way match at All In, and I thought she was fantastic. I'm really excited about it. I haven't been watching, so I can't say personally how it's been, but I've followed from afar how well Becky Lynch is doing on SmackDown, and I think that's great. I wish her all the best. And you know, Ronda Rousey signing and going to Raw and becoming a big star, like I think all of that is great. I think WWE, as they usually are, is being a little selective in their history. You know, it's like they want everybody to notice that they're pushing the women now as athletes and not just as like window dressing or the snack bar match or for TNA or whatever. But they want you to sort of forget that that's exactly what it was a few years ago. You know, they want you to forget about how they spent all these years promoting lingerie pillow fights and, you know, stripper matches and, mud wrestling matches and stuff, and just say, hey, look, we're promoting women's wrestling as a serious thing, and we're letting the main event now, and look, isn't it great? And they're sort of selectively ignoring all the stuff that they used to do that was pretty terrible. But yeah, I think it's awesome. And yeah, the Women of Honor division is great. And Ring of Honor, you know, that's like the indie company where that has that reputation of like, well, this is like the wrestler's company, you know, this is the company that was built on great matches and like hard hitting, you know, genre-defining wrestling, and for them to create a title and say, okay, we're going to seriously have a women's division in this company is really cool. I think it's great. And like I say, it's about time. It's long overdue.
Well, at this point in time, my co-host QT Vokes is standing by, and I'm sure he has questions as well. So, QT, go right ahead.
Well, thank you, Sun Guy. Hello, Steve.
Hi.
Steve, you spoke of working with Dr. Gregory. Do you plan on bringing him on Ensign's Log in 2019?
I haven't talked to Doc about that. I'm sure he would be up for it. That's one thing we haven't done on. And for anybody listening who doesn't know what the hell we're talking about, Ensign's Log is a comedy Star Trek themed podcast that I star in with my buddy Jason Harding, and that's something we haven't done yet. We haven't had a guest star. It's just been me and Jason doing it so far, and I think Doc might be good for that. I don't know who he would play, but I think Doc would be good for that.
Yes, Jason Harding plays the swashbuckling Ensign Reichert. Yes. Yes.
Actually, he's Ensign. He's Ensign Barkley. I'm Ensign Riker.
Oh, whoa! I couldn't. Okay.
Yeah.
I listened to two episodes. Okay, and I hadn't had.
If you, that's okay. Movie. If you mistook me for Jason, I take that as a compliment because he's the funny one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
well, Steve,
he's great.
What was your first memory of Star Trek, and did it have as much impact as the Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant episode?
You know, it must not have, because I can't remember the first exposure to Star Trek, like, specifically. I remember seeing that Hogan-Andre segment, and I can pinpoint that as, oh, that's when I became a wrestling fan. Star Trek, I can't remember the first time. I'm pretty sure it was one of the movies. I'm pretty sure it was like Star Trek II or Star Trek III or something, and it was probably on TV, and I was just a little kid, probably 4 or 5 years old, and I saw it, and I just fell in love with it and got interested in it, and, you know, flash forward 30 years, and here we are. I'm a huge fan, but it's for whatever reason, I can't remember, like, the very first Star Trek for me, but I'll always remember the very first wrestling because it's that Hogan Andre thing. It's just something that I think I've found when I was really, really young, and it just clicked with me, just like wrestling. It just, there's something about it that just clicked with me. And I just thought, I like this. I get this. I know what this is, you know, and this is, it appeals to me, but yeah, I can't think of what that first Star Trek thing was. It's interesting.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, did you hold backyard wrestling matches with your grade school pals? And if so, were you a babyface or a heel?
That's a great question. We kind of did. We did. We never, you know, we would wrestle in the backyard or in the basement, just me and some friends. And, you know, emulate moves that we did what you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to try this at home. We tried it at home, and I was never very good. I was always very uncomfortable, going upside down. So my move set was very limited, and I didn't like, you know, taking moves where I had to, you know, go upside down. So I wasn't really good at getting slammed or being suplexed or anything like that. Cause I was too scared to go upside down. But I had a buddy named Scotty who was, I mean, for someone who was never trained and who had no idea what we were doing, he was really cool, and he was fearless. He was like a daredevil. He would do Jeff Hardy moves. He would do the Swanton bomb. Like, he would jump off the bed and land on you on the floor. He must have known what he was doing enough, because nobody ever got hurt. We would backyard wrestle, and I was usually a heel. I liked being a heel more because you get to show more personality. For me, when we were just making up wrestling matches, having no idea what we were doing, not being trained or anything, it was easier for me as a heel to do a match because it was easier to think of things to do. Whereas, you know, if you're a babyface, you're sort of waiting for the comeback. You're waiting for the moment when you can cut off the heel and turn things around, and it's just not as much fun, you know, until you get to the end. If you get to the end of a match and you're the babyface and you get to do the comeback and you've got some cool moves to do for that, then that part is fun. But up until then, you're just sort of, you know, letting the heel work you over. And in that situation, I mean, you definitely want to be the heel. You want to be that guy. And that's usually who I was.
At any time during these backyard wrestling matches, did you and your pals form a spirit squad or a right to censor?
We there weren't that many of us. There were only about 5 or 6 of us at most. So we didn't really have enough people to like break into factions. And at the time when we were doing it, which would have been when we were preteens and teenagers, so it would have been in the mid-90s, so we were more like it was NWO. You know, that was like the hot faction at the time. So if we were going to emulate like a cool heel stable, it would have been the NWO, or maybe DX, although there wasn't as much DX love in our group of friends. There were a lot of NWO guys. And it's weird, like we probably wouldn't have done Spirit Squad because that would have been too goofy, and we were very serious teenage backyard wrestlers. We wouldn't have done anything goofy like the Spirit Squad. By the time the Spirit Squad came around, we had outgrown the backyard wrestling phase, but there were probably some wannabe NWO members in my group of backyard wrestling friends.
Wow. Okay. All right. Did any of your childhood friends have the charisma to form a Piper's Pit? Did you do interviews? Oh. And if so, how were your mic skills?
Yeah, we would do that. I think we would take turns. I'm tooting my own horn here. And self-praise is cheap praise, so take this for what it's worth. But I think I probably had the best mic skills of our group. And I think if I had ever tried to get into the business, that would have been my only way in. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I maybe if I had really set my mind to it and had really tried and gotten a couple of lucky breaks, I could have been like an interviewer or maybe like a heel manager or a commentator or something like that. Like, I don't think I could ever have been a wrestler. I'm not brave enough. I don't have a high enough tolerance for pain. I'm not athletic enough. I'm probably big enough. It's physically, I could probably do it if I wanted to, but I don't have the acumen for it. But, I probably could have been a talker. You know, I could have talked my way into the business. At least at a very low level, I could have probably gotten on like some indie shows or something and at least done something. But so I think my mic skills were the best. And that would have been, my only shot. If I had seriously wanted to get into the wrestling business, I would have had to be a talker of some kind.
Well, now speaking of people that do interviews and, yeah, as a talker, we lost an icon in the wrestling industry a couple of days ago, Mean Gene Okerlund. How big of an influence was Mean Gene Okerlund, specifically on the Ensign's Log?
Wow, you just pulled that one out of the clouds, didn't you? I don't think Gene is too much of an influence on the Ensign's Log, at least nothing that I can put my finger on. But I mean, he was Mean Gene. Like, he was the greatest. I think he was the best person who ever did his job. He was the only time I can ever think of when a wrestler would be being interviewed by somebody, either in that backstage area or out in the ring, where you actually cared about the person holding the microphone. And even though Mean Gene he was good because he never made it about him. He always made it about the person he was interviewing, which is what you're supposed to do. But he was so good at it and had such personality and was so funny and was so easy that you were glad that he was there. You know, he made it better just by being there, and he was so good. So, I mean, yeah, I don't think he influenced the Ensign's Lug. And he would have had to do it through me, because Jason isn't that much of a wrestling fan, but he would have had to do it through me. But I don't think there's any Mean Gene influence in the Ensign's Lug. But for me as a wrestling fan, it was very sad to hear about his passing, because like I say, he was the greatest who ever did his job. He was the best wrestling interviewer ever. And I just watched on YouTube the other day, after he died, someone shared, I think on Twitter, somebody shared a clip of him from 1990 when they did the Hogan earthquake injury angle, where Hogan, the earthquake, supposedly he crushed Hogan's ribs, and Hulk was out for months, and he was thinking about retiring, and they had everybody, they put an address up on the screen, and you had to write letters to Hulk to encourage him to get well. And they played it so straight. They played it like Hogan was just grievously injured and he was going to have to retire. And they treated it like he was dead. And Mean Gene had this segment, like, I guess the week after that happened, where he was so upset. Like, he couldn't even finish it. You know, they did a bit where they cut from Mean Gene to like a graphic with the address where you were supposed to write. And Mean Gene, he had a moment where he kind of choked up and he said, "I can't do this. I can't do this." And watching that now, that is so amazing, because that guy, he was not an actor. He wasn't like a trained professional actor. He was just a guy who had worked in wrestling since the 70s, I think, at that point. And that was what he did. That was his skill set. And yet he was so good at selling that and selling Hogan being like super, super hurt, like in a lot of danger. And he was so upset that Hulk Hogan, his good friend, was so hurt after this attack by Earthquake. And you watch that now and you think, man, that seems real. That seems like he's really that upset. That's how good he was. You know, he could do the funny stuff. He could banter and have funny interviews with Jake the Snake or Ric Flair or Roddy Piper or anybody, really. But he got serious that one time, too. And he was so good. I mean, it's a great loss. You know, it's really sad. There's never going to be another Mean Gene.
There probably won't. Yes.
No.
Yes. Now, will there be a debut of a young transgender ensign on the Ensign's Log in 2019?
Maybe. I don't know. We don't have any plans to introduce a trans character, but I would be totally up for it. What I'm waiting for, I would love to see a trans wrestler in like a major spot. I think we're still probably a few years away from that. They've already sort of, hinted at gay wrestlers or sort of gay friendly wrestlers. WWE has kind of done that a little bit. But they haven't
like
actually.
Well,
yeah, with Goldust. Yeah. They chickened out and they said, "Oh no, he's just playing mind games." You know what I mean? But, you know, there are some gay wrestlers on the indie scene, like Mike Perro, who is awesome, who's, you know, this really impressive guy. And there are other ones as well who have come out and said, you know, that made it like an open part of their personality and said, yes, this is who I am. And that's been awesome to see the last few years. So, you know, I don't. I'm waiting for the first like big time superstar trans wrestler. I think that'll be a really good thing. But I don't. We don't have any specific plans for a trans character in the Ensign's Log. But who knows? Who knows? That's up to Jason. He's the guy. He's the creative force behind the Ensign's Log.
Wow. All right. Okay. Well, Steve, if you could have the chance between these two superstars as a guest voice appearance on one of your Ensign Log episodes, who would you choose, Matt Groening of The Simpsons or Chuck Lorre, producer of The Big Bang Theory?
did you just pick names out of a hat? I would have to go with Matt.
Oh, okay.
I would have to go with Matt. I would have to go with Matt Groening. I would love to have him on the show to do anything he wanted, because The Simpsons is one of my all-time favorite shows. Not such a big fan of the work of Chuck Lorre, but yeah, I would have to go with Matt.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Well, now I listened to the Ensign's Log episode 14, Shore Peeves. My first question is, why did the captain plan a port of call for Liberty where they could scan your mind for amusement, the Pleasure Planet?
That's a good, you know, the better question is why didn't he do better research before he let everybody go? I mean, because if you watch that original Star Trek episode and then also listen to our Ensign's Log episode that is sort of built on top of that, it goes sideways like immediately. Things start to go wrong as soon as they get down on the planet and these, you know, sort of fantasy figures start appearing, and then everything goes completely sideways and it becomes this huge crisis. And if they had just done a little bit more research ahead of time, instead of landing on the planet and going, oh, hey, this is nice, the weather seems cool, hey, bring everybody down, you know, it probably would have worked out a little better. But yeah, that happens a lot in Star Trek. I feel like if the captains were a little bit more careful and they did a little bit of research before they put themselves and their crew in danger, it would be a way less interesting show. So in a way, so as a fan, I'm glad that the captains have a history of being so reckless and so short-sighted, because it gives us more interesting things to watch.
Well, you yourself, as Ensign Barkley, was looking forward to the 2018 Street of Dreams. Did they catch the guy in the red hat that was carrying a gun and a torch?
Yeah, well, again, Jason is Barkley, I'm Riker. But yeah, it's interesting that that's one of those little plot threads that we kind of dangled and we never really wrapped up. But yeah, it was Jason's character in the podcast is he has like sort of an interest in Earth history, and in the show we're in Star Trek time. We're living in the 23rd century, so 2018 is the past to us. And it was a pretty funny scene. He was quite surprised when his fantasy of being on Earth in 2018 went kind of wrong when he was chased by an angry group of people wearing red hats. I don't think they ever caught him, unfortunately. Hopefully, after we left the planet, that fantasy was dismantled, and all of those angry people were, you know, returned to the machine that they came from. But I don't know. Maybe they're still there. Maybe they're still there running around, pissing people off. I have no idea.
Okay. Well, at one point, Ensign Barkley asked you this question. How many more times were you going to die on this planet? And the answer was, how long is this shore leave going to last?
Yeah, that was something that Jason came up with. Because the way we do that show is it's mostly improv. We don't script it, but Jason will come up with kind of an overarching story for the show, and he'll say, okay, we need to do this and this and this. And then it's sort of up to us and our imaginations to how we get there. And that was a bit that he came up with where he said, okay, we're going to go down to the shore leaf planet, and I'm going to have died like 20 times. And of course, on that planet, when you die, they fix you and they bring you back to life. So you can die as often as you want. They'll always fix you. And his character had died by when we start our show, his character had died something like 20 times and was just like completely psychologically broken because he had been killed this many times. And I think my guy had died once or twice too, but I wasn't nearly as upset about it as he was. He was pretty traumatized, which again is something that they don't really think about. Like on the show, they're like, oh, you might die, but don't worry, they'll fix you, you'll come back to life. And they don't really bring it, you know, factor in that, I mean, getting killed would probably be pretty upsetting, you know, even if they did bring you back. It's like, you would still probably be a little messed up. You'd be happy that you were alive, but you'd be pretty messed up if you had died. You know?
Yes, well, it seemed everyone on the ship was looking forward to leave. One, because you hadn't had one for quite a while, and the week before you had gotten into fight with Romulans.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That was that was right after the Balance of Terror episode, I think, where there was it was pretty stressful. Yeah.
Well, at one point, Ensign Barkley was telling you, Ensign Reichert, about Yeoman Pratcher. Is she the rank of Lieutenant Junior Grade or an O2?
I've been a Star Trek fan forever, and I'm still, I think Yeoman might be like its own thing. I don't know if Yeoman is like I think if you're a Yeoman, you're not an officer. And if you're a Lieutenant Junior Grade, obviously you're an officer, and you wouldn't be a Yeoman. But that's one of those things that, like, on the original Star Trek, especially, like, you could kind of tell they didn't really care about that stuff. Because they didn't really go out of their way to explain how any of that worked. They were just like, oh yeah, that's Yeoman Rand or Yeoman whoever, and you didn't really worry about what her rank was.
Oh, well, a yeoman in the Navy or Coast Guard is one that is an admin specialist, and they usually take care of the people's personnel logs and information. A yeoman, yes.
Right. And would they have like a separate rank, or like, is yeoman sort of a rank unto itself?
Yes, usually yeoman is a petty officer, which is different from your officers. They're enlisted. Yeomans are usually enlisted. But you have people graduating from, like, a Starfleet Academy or the real Naval Academy that are admin specialists, and they work with the enlisted yeoman to take care of personnel records.
Okay. I guess that kind of fits because, you know, they have in Star Trek, they kind of treat everybody as though they went to the Academy. So I suppose, like, there must be a role at the Academy for people who don't end up becoming commissioned officers, because, like, they have, like, Chief O'Brien in Deep Space Nine is established as a petty officer, as a non-commissioned officer, and yet he also talks about going to the Academy when he was a kid. So obviously there's something at the Academy for people to do, even if they don't want to become officers.
Well, Ensign Barkley commented on how Yeoman Pratcher was thin in stature, and her dream was to go to this all-you-can-eat buffet. My question is, was it a Golden Corral?
I hope it was, because Golden Corral is the finest all-you-can-eat buffet that there is. Golden Corral, I think, is the last buffet standing in my area. We used to have a bunch of, like, buffet places around here, and they have all closed except for Golden Corral. So in the area where I live, I think the Golden Corral will probably be open for as long as they want. If Yeoman Pratcher knew what was good for her, she would have wished for a Golden Corral, especially the mashed potatoes. You can't, for cheap buffet instant mashed potatoes, it's probably the best you can get.
Yes. Well, Ensign, when was the last time you yourself underwent Pon Farr? I hear it's supposed to have it happen every 7 years, and it involves a Vulcan love cycle.
We haven't gotten there yet, but I think we're going to have to do that at some point. We're going to have to do a Pon Farr episode, because we've established that that Barkley, Jason's character, is part Vulcan, and we did a storyline over the last couple episodes. It's been a couple episodes since we finished it now, but where he brought out his Vulcan side to help us solve a problem, we're probably going to do some kind of Pon Farr episode at some point. It'll probably be when we get to the episode of the original series where Spock goes through his Pon Farr, which would be Amok Time, one of my favorite Star Trek episodes, where you have that great scene between Kirk and Spock where Spock is really super upset and moody because he's going through Pon Farr. And and Kirk says, "Hey, what's wrong, Spock?" And Spock's like, "It has to do with biology." And Kirk's like, biology. He's like, yes, Vulcan biology. And he's kind of hinting at it, but not wanting to talk about it. So, yeah, we'll probably do something about it there, I would guess.
Steve, do you know if any Klingons have any ghost ships under construction? Ghost ships.
Probably, you know, I guess it depends on who's writing the show. You know, it depends on who's writing the Star Trek show. It wouldn't surprise me.
Well, okay. Well, boy, that's it. I had so many other questions about Vulcan love slaves and the 14 shore thieves, mostly Vulcan love slaves. But unfortunately, we're out of time, or I'm going to turn it back over to Sky. Is there any chance I could ask you many questions online?
Yes, you could. You could ask as many questions online as you want.
Oh, okay. Wow, all right. Okay, because I got like a page and a half. Mostly it's like, that customer survey that you had to fill out, which you weren't looking forward to.
Great. Bring it on.
Oh, okay. All right, back to you, Sun Guy. The sound guy?
Yeah.